see following Ivan, whose life would be a lot less complicated if Miles intruded into it.
To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people.
Because history has shown us that courage can be contagious, and hope can take on a life of its own.
I will bring you hope, and I ask only one thing in return.
We move now, together.
Not at all. Hope is not lost today. It is found.
Hope is what keeps you going.
Even if the whole world is telling you to move, it's your duty to plant yourself like a tree, look them in the eye and say no. You move.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanty Show.
You know it's a bad dream when waking up here is an improvement.
I'm Alex.
I'm Stina.
I'm Trish.
And I'm Paul. And we're here on Reading Rangers today to talk about Brothers in Arms, the latest novel we've reached in the Miles Vorkosigan saga. This is the novel, readers, where Miles gets to find out that, hey, I really do have a clone brother, even though I've been pretending to have one for a little bit, and hilarity, in quotes, ensues.
The be careful what you wish for, you may just get it novel.
Yes. Yes, that's a very good way of putting it out. So we'll talk about what this actually novel is about, and then we will get into our impressions about the novel and how that all goes. So Miles gets to the embassy, which happens to be in London. He meets the end of the embassy there, who has no idea who Miles is because it's above his pay grade. And in fact, the embassy does not have the 18 gazillion credits that Miles needs to fix his fleet, because that would be more than the entire yearly budget of the embassy. So he's left cooling his heels. And in so doing, he runs into Ivan, who's been stationed there. And we can slowly start to see Ivan being modified from his original conception. I think this is one of the books where we actually start to see Boucher starting to feel bad for Ivan and starting to actually change him a little bit to be less of a prick, to be perfectly honest. And in cooling his heels and trying to get his money, he runs right into the plot to replace him with a 6 year younger clone. That would be Mark Pierre Vorkosigan. That he doesn't call himself Mark, but as Miles points out, it's a nice little bit of world building we hadn't gotten before. Beriar's sons apparently are named for their grandfathers, and so the second son of Arrow would be named Mark Pierre by Beriar custom and rules. So he's got a name ready for him, and Miles jumps on the idea of having a brother because he's an only child and he feels the need to, even as Mark is trying to replace him and cause ferment and division within Beriar, and even though Miles keeps pointing out, no, this is not going to work, that's going to work. And we find out that the mastermind behind this is actually Galini, the head of security of the embassy's father, who's this Komaran terrorist who's thought to be blown up years ago, but surprise, he's alive, well, and still causing problems. So we eventually get a bug hunt in and around the flood embankments around the Thames River as Mark, Miles, the Setagandans, who are still very pissed at Admiral Nadesmith, all show up and start playing each other in the greatest game of laser stun tag ever invented. And in the end, surprisingly, and it surprised me when I read it years ago, like, Mark gets away relatively free thanks to Miles' insistence and engineering to try to give his brother a chance at something, although I can tell that he really wants Mark to come with them, but he's willing to give Mark freedom rather than just being captured or dirt-napped, as the case may be. The Setagandans are foiled, the terrorists are dealt with, and Miles gets a brand new mission and money for it, which is the most important thing from Admiral Mace's point of view. And that's basically the plot, with lots of little fractal ornamental branches in and around there, and we can talk about some of those. All right, now that we've talked about the novel, why don't we get our first impressions, and we'll start with you, Alex.
So, I will say that Brothers in Arms is not my favoriteest, because that would be memory, but I do like it. It's kind of like, it feels like the series is really kind of hitting its stride, and Miles has really settled into being Miles, and it also, part of why I like it so much is it's one of the first kind of real indicators. I mean, that and Sergeant Bothari biting it back in The Warrior's Apprentice, that she's not afraid to really shake things up and really just like tectonically shift Miles's universe in ways that are going to keep coming back. Because like in Brothers in Arms, she introduces an entire new character, Miles's clone brother, who complicates his life in massive ways and who becomes like a major character in his own right, who gets viewpoints in later books. So spoilers, guys, he's going to be back. It's not just like a one-off thing where it's like, oh, I have a clone brother, and then he just sort of vanishes and we never hear back from him. He keeps coming back, which is part of the point.
This is not Star Trek.
No, this is definitely not Star Trek. This is like the soap opera where the evil twin does not just disappear into the sunset with your fiancé. So, like, that's what I really did like about it. I felt less, I don't know. Like, the other thing I honestly don't like about this book, because there's a lot I do like, but, and this is a personal thing, so please don't kill me, but I really don't like the romance between Miles and Ellie, so that's bleh for me.
No, I'm with you on that one.
Oh, good, I'm glad I'm not the only one, because mostly I'm just like, you're her commanding officer, this is gross!
Ding, 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 ding! Yeah.
I remember at the time when I first read this book, like, I didn't quite pick up on that. I will admit to being stereotypical. When I'm like, hey, Miles finally got some, which is kind of immature past me was immature in that way. It's like, yay, Miles has found love of some kind, even if she really loves Naismith and not Vorkazi, and that's nice and complicated, but at least Miles has found somebody. That's what past me thought. Present me sees the power dynamic here and the inappropriateness of a relationship between Ellie and Miles and is happy that, well, that'd be spoilers for Stina, since Stina hasn't read that far forward yet.
Right. No, I feel like it makes it even less appropriate that she's only in love with, like, a part of him. That makes it even more icky on just so many levels. Not that, you know, people don't go through phases where they have relationships that are not healthy or good for them, because we all successfully learn what we do not want in a relationship. But it did right away bother me how inappropriate it was for a commander to have an affair with a subordinate.
Yeah, like his direct subordinate.
Yeah, and it really bothers me that it's kind of put across that is like the only way he can have a relationship or something. It's kind of like, he feels like that's the only way he can have a relationship with is really super icky.
Yeah, well, between that and like the him getting it on with Tara after she's part of the Dondarrion, I'm just like, Miles, you got some problems, buddy.
Yeah, no joke.
Maybe it's a Barry Arn thing, but
exactly.
Smash the Barry Arn patriarchy.
Exactly.
So those are my impressions. So I think, Stina, over to you.
Yeah, I mean, there are things I like about, just like you, there are things I like about this book and things that I don't like about this book. I do admire the fact that when Bujold does something, it sticks, as far as the plot goes and character development goes. The things that happen to Miles don't just vanish into the ether and he goes blithely about his business unaffected. So I think that's one of the great strengths of this series, I feel. At least going into it thus far, and apparently that continues. The abuse aspects of it I found really disturbing, which is appropriate.
That's true. They're not treated lightly, at least.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, for me, that part of it was not comfortable, but that's what that's supposed to be. Not comfortable. But yeah, I did. There's a lot of it that I really enjoyed. I liked getting a little more insight on Ivan. I wanted to make sure that I mentioned that part. I really like that we're really starting to put together. It was mentioned in one of the earlier books that he was basically a slacker in order to avoid being seen by the powers that be, essentially, because otherwise he'd be in line for the throne. And then that would put him in danger. So I thought that was really emphasized here, which I really liked. I don't know. I like the way that even the most innocuous characters that you would just sit back and look at, like Ivan. I mean, normally I would look at that character and go, "Oh God, I have no use for that character whatsoever. He's such a bore. He's a womanizer, and I already can't stand him." And then to come back and realize that he's got a reason for doing the things that he's doing, and have some empathy for that, is that's a neat trick. I think she's really good at that. That's where I am with that.
Go ahead, Trish. That means you're up.
Okay, well, obviously, me being a twin, the introduction of Mark, the clone brother, which is what Miles eventually settles on calling him, my clone brother, that made a big impact on me. And I was surprised on rereading this for the podcast that it actually takes so long for the introduction of that part of the plot. I think it's more than about halfway through before we actually find out that this whole part of the plot exists. Up till then, it's been an embezzlement hunt and, you know, why isn't my money coming through yet story. Later, his identity questions of who he is, who he wants to be, what he wants to be doing, which, yeah, it's, you know, he's really gets shook up in this book.
Thank you. So, when I had first read Brothers in Arms back in the day, I had not read Borders of Infinity before it. I'd missed those novellas. I had just gone from novel to novel back in the day. So I'd actually read Borders of Infinity later and put together dots because for those readers, Borders of Infinity, which we discussed in our last episode, the set again prison camp breakout that Miles does is very, very in front in mind in this novel because it happens just right after that novella. Miles Fleet is limping to Earth and he's basically suffering from PTSD from the events of seeing people he came to care about die right before him. And I was really struck this time how well these two stories, the novella and the novel, actually fit together as a unified whole. It's not something I don't recall we've actually had that sort of tight of a lock between book A and book B is just happening right on top of each other like that, where the consequences of one go immediately into the next. And it's like, okay, now what do you do, hotshot? Sort of look at things rather than having Miles having time to actually process things and go forward with that. So I was really struck by that. I was struck that I misremembered things. I kind of remembered the Mark plot coming sooner in my mind than it actually does. And now that I've gone all the way through all of the novels and I've seen where Ivan's story eventually has gone, now I'm kind of like seeing it is for the first time. I'm picking out how Ivan's personality has changed and evolved from the earlier really, really unpleasant, sexist, borderline sexual assaulting Ivan to he's starting to see more nuance, especially starting in this volume. We start to see what's making him tick and why he does the way he does. So I really appreciated that part of the novel as well.
I think, obviously, I think Ivan is developing as a character because if nothing else, he's getting older and, you know, as he's growing and maturing, perhaps because of the influence of his mother and Aunt Cordelia, he's thinking a little bit less with his downstairs brain.
Right.
Yeah.
But sometimes I've also wondered, because Miles is so plainly the viewpoint character, if there's it's also like a subtle sign of Miles's understanding of his cousin kind of maturing and developing as well.
Sure, I could see that.
Miles, having grown up with him, he for the longest time he had a fixed view of what his cousin is, and it takes time and possibly even Miles growing and being able to see experiences as Admiral Naismith outside of Barry Yard to actually get a better look at his cousin and reassess him.
Well, here's the thing. I feel like he's actually kind of jealous of his cousin, right? On a certain level.
Yes.
Mm.
He really wishes he could be like that. And now I feel like at this phase, he's starting to see the problems in being like that and why at least that's my hope. Maybe it's just me reading into it. That my hope is that he sees that there's problems with treating women like that.
That's also part of my, like, I kind of wonder, you know, the reliability of Miles on this. Like, is Ivan really that much of a pig, or is Miles just like, oh, he's getting all the ladies. This must be how you get all the ladies. And then you find out from Ivan, he's like, I don't really get that many ladies. I just cast a wide net.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, it's good to, like, see the multiple layers to those relationships. And I think that's what makes the character development so much more interesting in the books.
Well, I think she's got, like, just this incredibly strong cast of secondary characters at pretty much all times.
And I personally feel like that's really important, particularly in this series. If you're going to have a series, you need strong secondary characters. Otherwise, the series just can't carry on, because hearing things from about one particular character for a whole series of 8-9 books or whatever is really boring.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get a lot of nuance unless you have secondary characters are developed like that. I think that's the trick to it. I mean, I see the same thing with Terry Pratchett. So I also wanted to, Paul, you were talking about earlier about how tight the short story comes up against this novel. And I agree. I mean, it just, to me, it added a whole nother level of urgency to what was going on, because he's basically coming out of one horrible disaster, psychological disaster, and then walking smooth right into a financial disaster straight away, and how scrambled he is as a result of that. Thinking back on it, I feel like part of the reason why the military response to his, hey, you guys, I need to go do some other stuff. And I feel like some of the reason why the military's response is, okay, you get to do escort duty for a while, is because they understand that he's probably going through some shit and needs to chill the hell out for a while and deal with that. But at the same time, they don't do it in a way that's actually helpful.
Yeah. Well, because he's a cog in the Beriarin machine, so to speak.
Yep.
Beriarin military still has to evolve along with Beriarin society, and it's nowhere near there. There's still two generations removed from cavalry charges, so, you know.
Yeah, I find that's really interesting that socially that is set up in this world, whereas I feel that a lot of the social movements within the military, at least the American military scene, is actually a little bit ahead of American society in some ways. I thought that was an interesting observation.
Yeah. And I mean, these books have always been like this really interesting exercise in what happens when technology changes so abruptly and, you know, the rest of society is trying to play catch up.
Yeah. It would be chaotic.
Well, yeah, that's what happens when you're a barely feudal society. You get invaded by quasi-aliens, because the Setagandans are really kind of alien. With high technology, you finally kick them off. Okay, now what do? You can't go back to what you were. You can't go back to the farm. So, yeah, so, and then not only that, you have an accelerant in the form of Cordelia Naismith, who is accelerating that technological and sociological change single-handedly. So since this is your first read-through and you're going with veterans here, so what did you think about Mark P. Air Force Cosgett?
I didn't like him, but you're not really supposed to, I don't think.
No, I don't think he's intended to be likable in this.
Yeah, I thought it was a really interesting idea. I felt like, coming at this as a writer, there are times when I feel like I can sense when the author woke up one morning and said, oh, hey, I've got an idea, and then they integrate it into the story. I feel like I can see behind the scenes a little bit because I've had these experiences. So I feel like she's been toying with the idea of him having an evil twin all of this time, and with Naismith and all this stuff, and it kind of felt like, hey, she woke up one morning and went, hey, what if he really does have an evil twin? What's that going to do? Which, I think that's really awesome. I really, really like that. I like the idea that he was raised to be an assassin, and I like that as a factor, and I like the
Time out. We might want to cut that. I think you're talking about the next book.
You're talking about Mirror Dance now.
Oh God, I'm sorry.
It's so hard to keep on track with all these 20 books they are.
the thing is, they do really run together because we're running into that thing where, you know, again, you never know. Are we talking about Mirror Dance or are we talking about Brothers in Arms?
They're so closely related.
And it's one right after the other, like.
Yeah.
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 Okay, sorry. So this is the one where he's in London and he gets kidnapped and he sticks in the room with the guy and they talk about the father and it's like father stuff.
With Dov Galini, who is one of my favorite minor characters.
I really feel for poor Dov. I mean, here he is trying to be a Qamar and being a good Beren. His father's ghost, who's not a ghost because he's actually still alive, just won't let him. And it's like, that's a real drag.
His father is such a dick.
Ugh. But then I understand his father being such a dick.
Yes.
I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah, well, his father is basically, it's like, you know, a religious fanatic when you come down to it. It's just his religion is freedom for Qamar.
Yes, that's exactly how that... No, it makes sense. I mean, having researched Northern Ireland, it just, that reaction makes sense, right?
Well, that's true, because that probably is a pretty deliberate parallel, I would bet.
Yep. So, I mean, I understand why he's such an asshole, but I also understand... empathize more with Dov.
In a really heroic way, imagine being a newly minted history professor and then making your way and then and trying to put the past behind you, and then the Bariarans open up the military service to Qamarans and he decides to sign up as a cadet and go through imp mill training and all, you know, being with his oppressors because he believes that integration is the way to go. It's really an amazing character, and I'm so glad that, you know, he doesn't just stay on Earth. We see him in later books, too.
Yeah, because Dov is just like, we lost, I just want to move on and find a new place for Qamar in this order. But then, you know, it's like his dad thinks he's a total traitor, and you're like, I guess, you know, from a certain point of view.
And on the same time, as Miles points out, poor Dov, he's trying to work his way through the service, but he's got to represent Qamar. But on the other hand, I mean, his superiors and all around him don't quite know how to handle him because have not handled it right, then it looks like you're punishing Qamar, being against Qamar. He's a landmine waiting to happen.
Mm.
And that's, I find that interesting because like suppose Dov got demoted and it got back to Qamar. Oh yeah, we finally get an officer in the service and they treat him like crap. There's fuel for the fires of rebellion. So poor Dove's military career has probably been rather far. I mean, consider he's been dropped here on Earth, which while is the cultural center of the universe, is not the political or military center of the universe. It's a third rate embassy, which is part of what poor Miles' problem is. They don't have the money for him because it is a third rate embassy, which is a nice juxtaposition that mighty Earth gets a squalid little building for its embassy rather than a full staff. So Dove's in charge of the security in a minor embassy, but even so, they can't treat him too badly because that has its political risks and fraught. So his career must have been really, really interesting. I now want a story from Dove's point of view.
I feel like history, when you're in the middle of history happening, is very complicated. All right? Nobody really knows when you're living it. Nobody really knows how things are going to end up or what the final story is going to be. History gets edited. And the thing is that people forget that history is messy. It's super messy. And there are a bazillion different points of view. There isn't just one perspective of what's going on. So on a certain level, when you're living in the middle of it, you don't know who is the one that's quote unquote right. Which story is going to be the one that ultimately gets adopted by history? I guess what I'm saying is they both have valid perspectives, even though we are, as readers, leaning towards empathizing more the son's political perspective of trying to just move on. You see what I'm saying?
So we're immersed in Barry Yar, so we're looking at the Barry Yar perspective as the quote-unquote right one, air quotes, right run.
I mean, to me, what makes me more sympathetic towards Dove is that Dove didn't have a clone created and then torture it into becoming an assassin, mostly. Like, that's the main thing that makes me be like, whoa, Dove, your dad is a total asshole.
No, I agree. His dad is a total asshole.
But I mean, honestly, like, if it was just, like, Dove and his dad yelling back and forth about, you know, Dove's a collaborator and his dad's, a terrorist or whatever, it honestly would not, I would have been a little more like, I can, you know, six of one, half a dozen of the other, I can see both perspectives.
No, I'm just talking about on a political level. I'm not talking about, I mean, the actions of his father are completely and utterly abhorrent. I mean, they're terrible.
But I feel like when you find out more, like when you get some stuff from Mark's perspective, spoiler in the next book, like then it's even worse.
Agreed. Very much agreed.
And I don't know if it's just like she decided to, you know, she was like, nah, he didn't seem bad enough. Or if it was just like, nah, here's just some stuff that no one would have guessed because Mark's not going to tell anyone.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to put a little thumb on the scales just to be sure that the readers get it.
By the way, this man is a bad man. Oh, but yeah, no, I totally see what you're saying as far as, like, the perspective, yeah.
I don't know. I like to add a little nuance to things and not keep things so simplistic. And I believe that that's what Bujold does in her work, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, because when we finally will get to Komar down the line in your future, yeah, we get to see a little more what Komar really is like and what the people there actually think. Yep, but that's future spoilers.
It's a really good book, by the way. I think you'll like it.
It is.
Awesome. Which one is that one?
It's called Komar.
It's called Komar.
Okay.
It's exactly what it says on the box. But that's the one after Memory, so we're actually not too far away from it. Anyway.
Yeah, anyway, back to Brothers in Arms.
So are we going to bring up the fact that Lyndon is not really a character in this story?
Yes, we'll deal with it briefly so we don't bore the listeners with a 15-minute digression on Earth and London in this novel, because that would bore people. But one thing I did not like about this book is that when I want to go to a place in the book, I want to know what that place is like. I want a sense of location, landmarks, a feel for the place. Especially if it's imaginary, but also if it's a place I've been to before. If you have a novel set in Rome and you don't even mention the Colosseum, the Pantheon, or Trevi Fountain, I don't feel like I'm, or eating gelato, I don't feel like I'm in Rome. That just feels like generic city and generic land. And this novel suffers from that because there's nothing about London that I found in this book. It could have been any town, any city on Earth for all that it was set in. It could have been Manaus, San Francisco, Abu Dhabi, anyway, for lack of description. All we get is the Thames, and the Thames flood in, there's embankments there, and that's it.
Right, and you can't really talk about the Thames and the embankments without at least mentioning in passing Cleopatra's Needle.
Yes! One of my favorite landmarks in London.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I understand, like, the sea levels have gone up, and I'm sure the landscape of the city has changed, but, you know, considering that even today, London is all about kind of milking the historic tourism for all it's worth, like, where the hell is Westminster Abbey, and why is no one telling Miles he should go to it?
And Parliament, for fuck's sake, it's right there on the freaking Thames! It's right on the bank! Parliament! Right there!
Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, I know Miles is not necessarily interested in tourism, but it would still, you know, all you need is a line of someone being like, oh, hey, you need something to do, you should go see the tower. And I guess part of why I was thinking about it is I was like, when I went there as an American, I was like, holy shit, I'm in a building that's like, you know, 1,000 years old or whatever. My mind is blown.
Yeah, 3 times older than our country. Yeah, I got that feeling too.
Yeah.
And then he'd be going somewhere that's like so much more ancient than even when his planet was colonized.
Yep. it would be even more so, right?
Yeah, so you think he would have a feeling about it.
Yeah, and there would be boats going up and down the river. Because there would be traffic. It's a waterway.
I mean, maybe she didn't feel confident about setting stuff on Earth. I mean, we get plenty of... I mean, when we're set in Beriar, in Volbar Satano, or Miles' home district, or any place like, or Jackson Hole, any place like that, I get a real sense of what the place is like and a nice sense of the world building, but here I didn't.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's why it's kind of disappointing, right? Is because she does such a brilliant job everywhere else, and then there's this hole. Which, I don't know, it may have been a moment where she's like, I don't really need to spend a whole lot of time describing London, everybody knows it, so, and everybody's been there, blah, blah, blah. We'll just move along. That might have been what the thought process is, and it also might have been, I haven't been there yet, so I'm just going to wave hands over it and move along. But who knows? Except to her.
It's true.
I do like how poor Miles is... The Sea to Gandans feel like they're scheming and plotting and then finally come out to actually do harm to Miles, and in the end Miles doesn't face them because Dove has, back to Dove again, Dove has taken care of the Sea to Gandan problem, which I appreciate. I mean, we in the in-game we have all these different factions swarming around, and Miles is afraid of the Sea to Gandans getting Naismith, and yeah, the Sea Gandans only show up as having been already dealt with by Gov, who was underestimated by
basically everybody.
By everybody, yeah, basically everybody there. It's by, not only by the Sea Gandans, but by everybody, and yeah, manages to keep himself intact and ahead of the ball game, which is great. But I like the idea. I like the Sea Gandans more here than actually in the novel Sea Gandans. I mean, I was as I mentioned on the earlier podcast, I wasn't that thrilled with that novel for some reason. Even given Kitten Trees, but here, I mean, the Sea to Gandans as adversaries, like, oh crap, when Miles is Skylar asking, are any of them painted with blue and red? It's like they feel like a menace that winds up getting taken care of, but they're always sitting there like that menace that poor Miles has to deal with because he's got his fleet bad, he's got his fleet down, he's suffering PTSD, he's got a clone now, and the Sea to Gandans want him. It's like on top of this giant pyramid of things on Miles. And I do like them as an adversary more than I like them as a point of view.
Yeah. I mean, I think we talked about it when we were talking about the Sea to Gandan novel. I kind of like that when the Sea to Gandans show up, they're almost a little ridiculous at times.
Oh, they're definitely ridiculous.
Yeah, I agree.
And, I mean, one thing I wanted to mention, like, about this novel is it is where I feel like you kind of get the first appearance of Miles's incipient identity crisis. Because before he's kind of, like, been, you know, I felt like in The Warrior's Apprentice and The Vore Game, he's very much playing Naismith as a role. And then when you get to through the Borders of Infinity and to this novel, Naismith has stopped just being a role that he feels separate from and has become like a distinct person that he is, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah.
And he'd been Naismith for a while by the time he gets to the embassy and has to become put on Vorkazigan again. I think this is some line about him having to remember how to be Vorkazigan. Play the Vorkazigan role, which is kind of a pointer towards what you're saying, Alex, about, yeah, it's like there's these separate identities now, not just roles that are facets of him.
And it's becoming more like like Miles Vorkazigan is more like the role he's playing, and he's really and I can understand why he thinks being Admiral Naismith, you know, like that is his preferred state of being, because Admiral Naismith is a fucking admiral and basically gets to do what he wants instead of Lieutenant Vorkosigan, who faces all of these constraints and is from a society that doesn't appreciate him and all that. But you start seeing the cracks kind of forming, especially with the thing with Ellie Quinn being like, well, I'm super into Naismith, but I'm not into Vorkosigan.
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like there's going to be core Miles in both of those personalities, and it feels a little weird that they are so viewed as so separate. I mean, I can see someone, I don't know, I mean, looking at it from Ellie's perspective, maybe it's a power thing for her too, because Naismith has a lot more power. Kosigan is just a lieutenant, which also, again, is kind of creepy.
I mean, it's almost as if Naismith is Miles unchained and unshorn of those previous, of those bounds that Miles Wilkosigan is wrapped around, buried on tradition, being his father's heir, the Barryon prejudice against quote-unquote muties, the Barryon social structure that Miles is all embedded in, and he's confronted with whenever he sees his cousin Ivan versus Naismith, where as you said, Alex, Naismith is commander of a bloody fleet. He's the head of the Andari Free Mercenaries. Granted, he's getting paid by Barryar, so he just actually doesn't have to worry about debits and credits so much because he's being underwritten. And until the end of this novel, he's got someone like Tongue to actually do a lot of the grunt work. So, I mean, Naismith, I don't want to say wish fulfillment fantasy because that doesn't sound quite right. It's like Naismith is almost like an aspirational state for Miles, where he can work independently, do what he needs to do, and be not bound by so many things, which actually ties into when Miles goes, spoilers, especially for Cena, because now that makes Miles' evolution much more logical.
I mean, it's that classic thing of, like, Naismith, men want to be him, women want to be with him, but apparently, yes, you know, at least more than they want to with Miles Wilkosigan.
Well, I feel like Naismith is the niche that he found in Barryaren, in the Barryaren system, to bloom and become what he absolutely could have been had he not had all of those previous restrictions. So it's the one space where he can ultimately be the person that he really could be, because he's allowed to use his intellect and problem-solving skills, and it's valued, and he gets rewarded for that, right?
And it's his opportunity to be an admiral even younger than his dad was an admiral.
Exactly. I don't know, I feel like it's a really interesting thing that she's setting up this whole, okay, this is this person, and you can be really successful here, and you are this other person who's not really successful, who's just his dad's son, and everybody looks at him in that perspective, and not as successful, and definitely reined in quite a bit, and, you know, everybody's always, oh, Miles, whatever, Miles.
And I think there's a lack of pity in Naismith. I mean, lots of people, if they have a reaction to Miles, it's like, poor Miles, he's genetically deformed, he has broken bones, he's never going to be the big, strong Barryaren that he could have been. Poor, poor Miles. No one says poor, poor Admiral Naismith. They all say, this is the baddest whose name can conjure fear and dread. I mean, the Set Agains want to kill him, he's so bad.
Yeah, no, and I feel like that's a big factor. But at the same time, there are aspects of Miles that Naismith lacks. Naismith lacks a certain level of Miles seems to have a broader view of how things might affect other people. Naismith just does shit.
He's more id.
Yeah, he's like Miles' little unchained id, where he is much less empathetic, I feel like.
Yeah, I wanted to use that word, but I wasn't really sure if that's necessarily correct, because it's not that Naismith doesn't care about what happens to his people. He desperately cares about what happens to his people. He just doesn't think as many steps through on what his plans are, and so sometimes they end up doing a lot of harm in the process, is kind of my feeling on it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that does make sense.
So it's as if Miles having to deal with all of the restrictions, it makes him slow down and really think about, do I really want to do this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Naismith, not having any of that, not having any of those restraints whatsoever, just does shit.
Being unchained from a bureaucracy is perhaps not the best thing for Miles.
Exactly. And I think that that's ultimately what she's saying on a certain level. You know what I mean?
Miles needs limits. Otherwise, Miles goes off the rails and it doesn't end well.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So for me, this is connected to the whole idea that power, absolute power, corrupts absolutely, right? So I feel like that's a good example of that. Not that Naismith is doing horrible things. He's not. It's just he's a little more reckless.
Well, yeah. And that recklessness bit him in the butt in Borders of Infinity, where he had a relatively simple, straightforward mission, and he turns it into, because he's Admiral Naismith and he's playing that role, he turns it into a gigantic prison breakout. He didn't have to. And he did, and he suffers the consequences of going through the guardrail.
Yeah, going off script.
So I think Busho definitely does show that without boundaries, Miles or anybody else is ready to be Icarus to go have the wax melt on his wings and go crashing into the ocean.
Yeah, hubris.
Hubris. Thank you.
Yes. That is very true, which it's a good setup for later stuff that I like.
I do think, yeah, this novel in the end, even though we've been conflating it with other stuff, really does help, does change the focus. It provides a new character in Mark. It provides a new relationship for Miles in the form of his relationship with his clone brother, Mark, because Miles hasn't had a sibling. The closest thing he had is, well, Ivan. And Elena, yeah, and Bathory, but that's Bathory.
Yeah, well, and he, that, like, his whole weird crush thing on her is just...
Yeah, I'm glad we're past that mostly at this point.
The nice guy crush, yeah.
Miles' relationships with women...
He's got some problems, like...
Yeah.
It's going to take a while for him to get through those. But that's also true of Ivan, so, you know, grow and learn better.
I think the other important relationship that does come back up is actually his relationship with Dove Gallini. Like, because Dove is another recurring character, and there it's not like some kind of familial relationship or even a really close friendship, but it is an interesting association and friendship with, like, my dad super hates your dad. Let's be friends. And I mean, like, later on, it's basically like poor Dove just wants to keep his head down and make it in the Barriari military and be, you know, if you're trying to keep your head down, being friends with Miles is not the way to go, or being associated with Miles, whether you want to or not, is not the way to go.
See, following Ivan, whose life would be a lot less complicated if Miles didn't intrude into it at frequent intervals.
Yeah.
I mean, Ivan here gains his claustrophobia, which will come up later on in future works. Here, because Ivan gets kidnapped, that this is where he gets that problem, which permanent disability on his character sheet that will come up again.
Yeah.
That's true, yeah. That's what I mean. I think that's part of why I like these books so much. Is she's so good at playing effects forward. So once you've read the entire series at least once, if you go back, you're like, oh, I can see how this goes all the way through down the line and continues to affect this character, and it's not just like a one-off, which I appreciate, because that, especially when you get into long series, they tend to become kind of like Star Trek episodic, and it's that's why I don't read those very much.
So this is why, readers, we suggest that you start from the beginning and you follow reading with us rather than just diving into a novel, because in many ways the sum is greater than the individual parts for this series.
For a lot of the books.
How many different series do that? I mean, I know Discworld does. And this is the only other one I've come across that does that.
Yeah, at least to this degree. I mean, sometimes it'll be like, oh, remember that guy I pissed off 2 books ago? Now he's back and he's the boss that I have to defeat in this book, but...
Right.
Yeah.
So it's basically just her and Pratchett that do this?
I mean, I'm sure there are others, and the readers can let us know, and please don't yell at us too much because we haven't read everything in the world.
Not even me.
And certainly not me. But I would be interested to know if they're in finding out.
Yeah. Dear readers, let us know if there's anyone who does it. And we're talking about to this extent, where it's like, now I'm going to tectonically shift the entire series and keep moving it forward, instead of it's like a little more formulaic, you know?
Which has its risk, because not every book will always work for every reader when you do stuff like that. See, following Setaganda.
True.
And a couple others just... I mean, some books work better than others for me, and I accept that as being the Bujold way, or being the Miles Forcosgan way, that there's going to be ups and downs, and we're heading towards a big up, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah? Excellent.
Yeah, I think the next book is Mirror Dance, and then I will just note that the book after Mirror Dance is my favoriteest book in the entire series, so I'm super excited.
Memory, yes.
Yeah. Memory is my favorite. I love it so much. But, you know, Mirror Dance isn't bad. We'll get through it.
So I want to thank you listeners for listening, and I want to thank my co-hosts Alex and Stina for joining me today to talk about Brothers in Arms.
Thank you for having us.
Always happy to talk about the Bujold books.
You're welcome, citizen. You're welcome.
Stay frosty, listeners. Stay frosty.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you'd like to support us, you can find us at patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do so at our email at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com, on Twitter at skiffyandfanty, and on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro and outro music comes from Dimension by Creo. You can find out more about them at freemusicarchive.org.